Fruits of the Science podcast with your girl and with Anne.
Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Roots of the Science podcast with your girl Anne with an E. My guest today is Lame Kumbangula Amungongo from Namibia. He's a student at the University of Manchester in the UK. Lamek refers to himself as a tech activist who loves to inspire more people to be involved in the field of technology. His background is in computer science. However, he's now studying towards his PhD in cancer research. This might not make sense to some, but he explains how he applies machine learning and artificial intelligence to his PhD to inform treatment specifically for lung cancer. In this episode, he talks about this research. He also lets us know about the DARA Big Data program that he's involved in. We discuss the importance of training young Africans to develop African-centered apps through the Google Developers Group initiative that he co-led in Windhoek, Namibia. Lastly, Lamek discusses the importance of digital literacy amongst ordinary people, especially as the world moves towards the fourth industrial revolution. You'll hear about all this and so much more. Do stay tuned. Hi, Lamek, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I'm so excited to find out more about you and everything that you're doing.
No worries. I'm also excited to chat to you and to your viewers as well.
Okay, great. So with that being said, can you just tell us a bit of about yourself, where you're from, where you're based currently now, and what you do, as well as away from the... please just tell me.
Yeah, so my name is Lamek. From Namibia. I was born in a small village called Ehenye nearby Oshakati.
Okay.
And I grew up there in Namibia. I was born and raised there, and recently moved to the UK, where I'm currently doing my PhD in cancer science at the University of Manchester. And yeah, that's pretty much about me. And I'm known by different titles, but I call myself just as a tech activist. I love technology and I like to inspire more young people to take up technology, and because I see that as the future of the world.
Oh, fantastic. So you said you're from Namibia, and so just before we get into the science and what you're all about, I just want to find out, tell me one place, if I had to go to Namibia for holiday, that I have to come and visit, and why?
Namibia is such a beautiful country. That's why even in our national anthem, we have the Namibia, the land of contrast and beauty. So, and if you just land in Namibia, or if you just cross the Namibia into the Namibian borders, the beautiful landscape of Namibia will already just take you by surprise. And I think, but there are so many places to visit, but depending on what you should visit, but I will always advise someone to visit our beautiful Namib Desert. It's the oldest desert in the world. And it's the only place where you're going to kind of like see what you call the dead flea in sources flea. I visited it last year and it was amazing. And yeah, I will actually encourage you to visit it if you find yourself in Namibia anytime soon.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. No, I'll definitely put that on my bucket list. But now to just get into you and what you're all about, you said that you describe yourself as a tech activist, right?
Yes.
But before that, I just want you to give me a brief overview of your educational background in terms of where you studied and your qualifications, and also what are some influences that got you into this industry?
Oh, wow. Thank you for that question. I studied in Namibia. I did my undergrad and bachelor's in Namibia, and master's in Namibia. But I'll, unlike many African children, I was very lucky to go to a good high school where mm-hmm. I had computer studies as a subject. And it was during this time studying computer science that I got into programming, doing small writing small programs in Turbo Pascal that time. And mm-hmm. I remember in 2006, I was in grade 9 that time, and I asked my dad to buy me a computer, and he bought me a computer, and I took my patient further, started developing small stuff, and which I did not commercialize any of them. Mm-hmm. But after high school, I wanted to become a lawyer, probably because majority of my friends in high school, we all applied for law, but I also applied for computer science because it was my passion. However, I could not pursue law because my father did not want me to pursue law.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because he was like, no, law is not your passion. Your passion is computer science because this is what you do every day. So if you pursue computer science as a career, you're going to enjoy it because you love doing it. I listened to my father's wise advice and pursued my degree in software engineering. And then later on, I continued with my master's in computer science.
Wow.
So my father has really been the person that guided me throughout my career. And today, in the field or in the field that I love the most and doing things that I enjoy.
No, fantastic. I think it's your dad was onto something. I think sometimes just following what everybody's doing is not necessarily a good thing. And you mentioned that he was the one who bought you your first computer. So clearly he saw that in you at a very young age. And we're thankful that your dad got you into this industry. So you said in your introduction at the beginning that you're now currently based in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
And you are enrolled at the University of Manchester.
Yes, I'm enrolled at the University of Manchester.
Yes, so pursuing your PhD now. So mm-hmm. can you just explain to me what your PhD is about and tell me more about this research?
To many, this may be confusing because my background is computer science. And now I'm pursuing a PhD in cancer science. Just to the listeners, they should not be confused. I'm still applying machine learning techniques, data mining techniques to healthcare data. But specifically on my PhD, I'm working with medical images and writing algorithms and models to kind of find patterns in these images, lung cancer images, and then using the new information that we derive from these medical images as to kind of like inform or personalize treatment for lung cancer patients. So it has been a learning curve for me as a computer scientist who has just been used to developing software and things like that. As now I'm kind of like still developing, writing code, but trying to apply the computer science knowledge into a new area, which is healthcare, and using that to kind of make sure that we individualize treatment for every patient.
Okay. So I'm just going to backtrack, like you said, but I really would like you to just clarify. How did you pick why lung cancer in particular? And like you said, that you came from this background of computer science. How do then those two, as one might think that they're very contrasting fields, then meet? How did you get into that? How did you even get into this program? If you can just backtrack a little bit.
Thank you very much. I think that's it's a good question. And how I got into lung cancer, I don't know. I always say that my curiosity brought me where I am currently. However, in 2014, I did a small project. It was for an honors project, you know, in Namibia, in South Africa, some Southern African countries. After a bachelor's, you can do an honors.
Yes.
So during my as part of my honors, I did a project on using MRI images to kind of like to create an outdoor detection system using MRI images for prostate cancer. It was just a simple, small project. It was nothing as complicated as I'm doing currently. And it was during that time where I saw that machine learning or these data mining techniques can be really useful in healthcare. And I 3 years later, I saw this advert by Dara that they are having a program or a project in cancer science, but the requirement is that you should at least know how to code, and computer science should be your background and stuff like that.
Okay.
As part of the Dara Big Data program. And I saw that as very interesting, and my curiosity was like, oh, let's give this a try. It would be fun and interesting learning something and applying the little knowledge that you know about coding and computer science in a whole different area. I gave it a go, and then I was lucky to be selected, and now I'm here.
Okay. So just for those who don't know, what is this the DARA program about, and what does DARA actually stand for?
The DARA program is it's a program that is a partnership between the Newton Foundation and the South African and the South African radio astronomy. So the whole idea is that they want to train Africans, young Africans, to in the whole area of big data, from astronomy, in healthcare, and then agriculture. So as you are aware that, you know, if you are aware of the SK, the square kilometer array, of this conglomerate of telescope in all these different areas, part of that telescope is also going to be based in in Africa, in the Karoo. It's been built in the Karoo in South Africa, in the Karoo region, but there are also other partner countries such as Namibia, Ghana, Zambia, Kenya. Yeah, there are about 8 partner countries. So all these countries are then working together as part of the SKA in Africa. The SKA is going to give us a lot of data. It's going to give us so much data, and we should find better ways on how to handle such large data. So the program such as Dara Big Data then prepares young African future leaders to be able to kind of deal with huge data that will be the SKA will be giving.
Okay, that's very interesting. Thank you for painting that back picture. I think it now sums everything together, and we can now understand it better. So now we're gonna go a bit back, right? So from 2013 to 2018, you co-led the Google Developers, an initiative in Namibia, where you guys organized tech-related talks, like you said that you are a tech activist, and hackathons and tech seminars. So tell me more about that and why it was so important for you to be part of that initiative.
Yeah, so I think let me start first with answering the why question, because I think that's the important part. If you to remember, like in the early, not early, but around 2008 to 2010, we have seen an increase in the number of smartphone in usage in Africa. A lot of people started getting more smartphones because they became cheaper and readily available, in the sense that more suppliers or more manufacturers or makers of such smartphones came into the market. And mostly the market was dominated by Android phones.
So it became
necessary to then train young people that can actually develop phones or that can develop application for these phones. And this is important because if you have smartphones that all that everyone is using, if we don't have local content, we are all going to end up consuming application or using applications that are developed in the Western world. Yeah, so we saw it as necessary as training young people to actually then be able to leverage on these widely available smartphones, so that they can develop our own local content, which you can, from e-education to e-health, to facilitate learning in schools, and also to facilitate equitable healthcare, or healthcare more accessible. And then when we, because before we started this, we started it as a small group, about seven of us. Then the group grew larger. And then in 2013, together with a good professor, as a professor of mine, we actually established the Google Developers group in Windhoek. And basically, by creating a GDG, this then enabled Google to then fund our events, meaning that so we could actually have more events and allow Google to help us with some funding, which enabled us to then cover, like cater breakfast and provide some refreshment during our meetups and also during hackathon events that we hosted, that we have been hosting. And the good thing about having a community like this, it helps us create create and build synergies within our small tech ecosystem in Namibia. Because at this meetup, we then had those that wanted to learn coding and those that are running, for instance, tech startups, all coming in one room and them sharing information. So it it also acted as that place where people networked and actually connected. Because sometimes you find somebody who just have an idea, but they don't necessarily know how to implement. And in this community, they'll come to this community and they'll find people with who has knowledge on how to develop mobile apps, who have knowledge to develop applications in general, and they get to network and they further on take these collaborations, they further collaborate together and come up with solutions. And that's one thing that we saw as very unique, and it was actually very helpful in helping the developer community flourish in Windhoek. Because currently today we see applications that are in the market that were developed by people that we trained. When they started, they did not have any idea of how to even develop a mobile application. But today, they are actually, they have actually built startups based, they've built startups and creating solutions And yeah, some of those things we are happy to see after putting in a lot of effort and after such a long time of working with the developers in Vendor.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. I think it is very rewarding. And like you stated earlier, that if the reason why you started this initiative or you saw the need for this was that you didn't want the market to just be swarmed with Western apps. So now you have Africans making apps, and that is absolutely fantastic. And I think, like you said, it must be so rewarding to be like, oh, I taught that person or I helped that person, you know, once they reach that level. So that's very exciting, and I commend you for you and the work that you did during that time. And so just another follow-up based on that question. Currently, it's hard to run away from the COVID-19 virus in any discussion, right? But yeah. And recently, you were featured in an article where you proposed a data-driven approach to COVID-19 in Namibia. Mm-hmm. And you did this by hosting another hackathon. So can you just tell us more about this and why you think it is important to do that?
So I wrote the article, but I did not organize the hackathon. The hackathon was actually organized a collaboration between GIZ, which is a German organization that works together with another organization in Namibia called Dololo.
Okay.
Yeah, they and partnership with government agencies. They created this hackathon where they actually allowed. Because if we to start before we go into what the hackathon was about. So a hackathon is actually like a sprint, but in this sprinting, people are coding. So people are writing programs or they are writing solutions. So and usually a hackathon will be of a period of a weekend, which is 48 hours. And in those 48 hours, those involved in the hackathon usually don't sleep. They they will keep on writing their applications until when they have to present their solutions. So there was a hackathon called Hack Namibia. So and the idea of Hack Namibia was then to come up with applications that can, local application or local solutions that can actually help government with some of the challenges that we are faced in dealing or in managing COVID-19 situation better. And some of these challenges are, for instance, contact tracing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very difficult, for instance, for one to do contact tracing if you do not have the machinery, the AI machinery such as that of China, where they've actually used like artificial intelligence to track everyone, and they were able to, with a certain level of accuracy, to tell where everyone has been to. So if someone tests positive, they were able to know with a certain level of confidence that this person was here, and that they've been in contact with A, B, and C. Although D was also in the same area, but they were not there together, the likelihood that this person was not in contact with the person who tested positive is maybe 50%. So countries like China are able to do that. However, for countries that don't have the same machine, they can rely on smaller applications that that can, for instance, use Bluetooth and GPS to actually just track the who was in the same vicinity or in the same radius as that person. And if, for instance, you enter an area where there is it's an epicenter, for instance, COVID-19 cases, Your Bluetooth can even notify you, and that application can notify you in your phone that the area where you are is an epicenter. So it's solutions like that. But I think what I was trying to get into the application is that, is to make this point that, you know, although majority of African countries were kind of imposing these nationwide lockdowns, I think they were, although they are good, they won't necessarily be that effective, because you are imposing a national lockdown. However, in a certain area, there might not even be a case, or in a certain region, there might not be a case. Why do those people have to go on
lockdown? Have to be in lockdown.
So if you have then data of where the cases are, you can then use that to then lock down those areas and make sure that nobody comes out in those areas. While in the areas where there are no cases, you actually allow economic activities to continue. As much as health is, the health of citizens is important, their livelihood is also very important.
Definitely.
And you can't really choose between either, because if people are not able to go out and make their daily living, which they actually survive on, they will still die of hunger.
True.
So what I was trying to actually the point that I was trying to make in the article was for government to rapidly test, randomly test, and then be able to then locate where the epicenters are, and use that information to actually make lockdown measures effective.
No, you do have a point there, and especially because in most of these African countries, we've got a very large informal sector that does not have the luxury of continuously getting paid. There's a lot of people who require day-to-day activities for them to earn an income. And like you said, if they aren't earning an income, it means that they might actually die of hunger then, before they might even die of the coronavirus. So I see what you're saying there. Just to go back on that, did the hackathon produce results that were efficient, that the Namibian government could actually use?
The solution that I saw that came out of the hackathon seems to be very reasonable solutions. And of course, you know, things that mostly what you get out of the hackathon is a concept that shows how certain solution work. But for it to then go in production, meaning that it's for you and I to have access to that solution, or for you and I to use such a solution, it might still need further development. And I think with the support of government, such solution can be further developed fast, quickly, so that people can start using them, and hopefully that will be the case in the with the three solutions that were picked as the best out of the hackathon. So we'll wait and see. Hopefully, in the next few weeks, we might get some solutions into the market that will be used. Looking forward to that.
No, I'm also very looking forward to that. So we hope there'll be a follow-up article where you discuss those solutions with people. And we hope that the government does buy in and fast tracks that process. So you seem to be very well versed in your area of expertise, right? As you're explaining right now, and I'm sure as the listeners can also hear. And as a result, you're also a lecturer at the Namibian University of Science and Technology, and you actually taught artificial intelligence and programming. So for somebody who's never been in a class of that sort, but you know, I'm curious, if I was one in one of your classes, without going into too much detail and to being too technical, what are some sort of things that I would learn in your in that class?
With artificial intelligence, such a
like just something
sounded perfect, right? Yeah. Yeah, so of course the thing that you learn in any class of artificial intelligence is that machines can think. And it's actually so interesting that the first person to ever think of or to ever propose the idea that machines can think, or the first person that asked the question, can machines think, was Alan Turing, the father, who is also known as the father of modern computer science. And do you know, and when he asked this question, he actually asked this question in 1950.
Wow.
Yeah, so already in 1950, Alan Turing already foresaw that we'll come to a point where we'll have intelligent computers.
Mm.
Yeah, so, and I think in any artificial intelligence class, I think that will be one of the first things that you will learn, and you'll learn about the experiment that Alan Turing ran to test machine intelligence, where he actually put, he had actually two examples, one with a human being and one with a machine. And the whole idea was for then you, as somebody on the other side, to then interact with either, to interact with all of them. And if you don't tell which one is a machine, then that that shows that machine is the same level as it's also intelligent and it can think. That's why it can mimic that human behavior.
Wow, fascinating.
So, yeah,
that's very, very interesting. And I wish that one day I get to sit in a introduction of artificial intelligence class just to hear more about this. Just to wrap it up now, after everything that you've taught us, I just want to ask you, you know, what advice would you give somebody who wants to get into your area of expertise in terms of in tech specifically, or artificial intelligence, or data mining, you know, about what advice would you give to them?
My only advice, not only to anyone who wants to get into computer science or any technical field, but to everyone in general, is that in today's digital era, or in today's digital world, coding has become the new literacy. That's why it's important for everyone to learn how to code. Because whether you are going to be a doctor, or you are going to be you are going to be a nurse, you are going to be to at some point interact with an artificial intelligence application or model or system somewhere in your daily life. And it's important for you to then be able to understand how that, what goes on behind that model. I think also more importantly, as we are faced by the fourth industrial revolution, where we are going to see the fusion of all these so many things, technology and also the mechanical and the electronic stuff, for us to fully participate in this era of the fourth industrial revolution, we need some sort of level of digital literacy. And the digital literacy is just not you knowing how to open Microsoft Word and typing.
Yeah.
Is you understanding how the inner working of computer programs, how those instructions are written, and how the machine actually interprets such instructions.
Yeah, no, that's very true. So, like you said, you did mention post, even now we're entering into the fourth industrial revolution, so we have to be very digitally literate, and you know, we have to join the bandwagon, because like if not even in even as a normal everyday person, even if you go to the bank now, there's artificial intelligence. So everywhere you go, you are going to be faced with all of this type of information. And Lamek, thank you so much for chatting with us. I learned a lot, and this was a very interesting and very informative chat. So I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Lamek, thank you so much. And I think one thing that I also would like to add, especially for African young people,
yes,
why computer science and digital tools are so important is that they will really enable us to leverage on data and digital technologies to actually build or find solutions to our own problems. And this, it's going to be helpful in so many ways. So we will be able to make sure that we build applications that will enable or will allow us to include that those people that have been excluded in participating, for instance, in banking. That's why you see that things, solutions such as M-Pesa, they are helping to actually bank the people that were previously not bankable.
Yes.
And I think also one thing is also the quality of education, because now we have this huge disparity of between the private education and the public ones. Digital tools or AI-based solution might also help us to make sure that we provide quality education for all, even just people learning through their smartphones or learning through their just normal phones using USSD and stuff like that. And I think most importantly is going to help us find cheaper solutions that's going to make healthcare, that's going to provide affordable quality healthcare for all. Because the amount of disparity between public healthcare and private healthcare on the continent is unimaginable. So if we can leverage on some of these digital tools, they can really help solve and help us find solutions to our own problems.
No, that's very true. As Africans, we need to find, because it's sometimes, like you said, the M-Pesa thing, it's only if you're in Africa would you understand, and if you're in Africa and an African, would you understand the importance for that app. So it's very good that there are people who can see, like, there's an issue here in my community, so how can I develop something to help them? So I'm very excited for the future, and all the amazing people who are going to come. Amazing people like yourself who are going to create, help us minimize our own problems and to create successful technologies for the future. So I look forward to it, and all the best with you and your research and all of your future endeavors. It was great having you.
Thank you so much, and it was nice chatting to you.
Oh, definitely was. And to everybody else, thank you so much for listening to the Root of the Science podcast with your girl Anne with an E. Until next time. Bye.